Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we present the 2012 University Lecture. Our speaker is Professor Tamar Frankel from Boston University School of Law. Professor Frankel's lecture is titled The Ponzi Scheme Puzzle, the story behind some of the biggest liars in history. Introducing our speaker is Boston University President Robert Brown. We begin with a greeting by University Provost Jean Morrison.
It's my great pleasure to welcome all of you to the 2012 University Lecture. Since 1950, the University Lecture has offered members of the BU community and the general public an opportunity to hear from distinguished faculty about the outstanding and often groundbreaking research and scholarship in which they're actively engaged. It is a forum that's open to all, students, faculty, and staff at the university, as well as our neighbors in the greater Boston area. And it is a forum that's designed to spark consideration and discussion of issues that are critical to our understanding of the world around us. And to introduce our 2012 University Lecture, it's now my great privilege to welcome to the podium the president of Boston University, Dr. Robert A. Brown.
It's my distinct pleasure tonight to introduce our speaker this evening for the 2012 University Lecture, Professor of Law Tamar Frankel, who will speak on the Ponzi scheme puzzle. The phrase ripped from the headlines is more often used when introducing a blockbuster film, or more typically a made-for-TV movie, than when introducing a university lecture. But tonight it is particularly appropriate. I can't imagine there is a person here tonight who hasn't heard of Bernard Madoff or who didn't follow the news of his corrupt scheme and eventual downfall. Most likely, many of you know someone who was directly affected by his theft of investors' money or by other such con artists. Our speaker tonight is widely recognized as one of the leading experts in the nation and the world on financial system regulation, fiduciary law, and corporate governance. She is the author of 10 books in the field, including The Ponzi Scheme Puzzle, published this year by the Oxford University Press, which serves as the basis for tonight's lecture. She is also the author of 15 book chapters and more than 62 articles. She's been a guest speaker, chair, and panelist at more than 70 conferences around the world over the past few decades. Professor Frankel joined the faculty of the law school in 1967 as a lecturer. She was named an assistant professor in 1968 and a full professor in 1971. Currently, she is the Michaels Family Research Scholar and a professor of law. She's been a visiting professor on several occasions at Harvard Law and the Harvard Business School, at the University of California Law School in Berkeley, and the University of Tokyo. She's been a fellow and visiting scholar at St. Catherine's College in Oxford, the SEC and the Brookings Institute, and she's been a consultant to the People's Bank of China. What a resume. She began her legal career as the assistant legal advisor to the Israeli Air Force and then worked as the assistant attorney general for the State of Israel in the Legislation Department of the Ministry of Justice. She worked in private practice in Tel Aviv before coming to the United States in 1964. Here she worked for Arnold and Porter in Boston and Washington, and was special assistant to the Commissioner of Corporations for the State of California before joining our faculty. Professor Frankel has testified before Congress on several occasions, most recently in 2009 before the Subcommittee on Financial Regulations concerning the Madoff Ponzi scheme. Professor Frankel is a respected and beloved teacher and an outstanding scholar and living proof that hard work and good scholarship can keep us young. Now it is my pleasure to invite Professor Frankel to deliver the 2012 University Lecture.
Thank you. Thank you very much. President Brown, Provost Morrison, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss my book, The Ponzi Scheme Puzzle. This presentation is not designed to express judgment. It is not a legal discussion either. though many of the facts were taken from court cases. This presentation is descriptive. Its purpose is to learn, to understand, and to invite ideas and opinions about a social problem. So what is a Ponzi scheme? It is a scheme in which a con artist offers investments that promise extraordinary returns at low risk. Presumably, the returns derive from a business or from a product or from a financial arrangement. But in fact, they don't exist. The money to pay the current investors and finance the con artist's lifestyle is raised from other new investors. Do all investors lose in this game? Not necessarily. The first groups can recoup their capital and get high return. But most of the later investors lose all. The schemes end when no more investors are available. Are Ponzi investing schemes a new phenomenon? Not at all. One report noted that in 1884, Ulysses Grant, retired president of the United States, lost money in such a scheme. There are many similar cases throughout the years. Who are the victims? They are wealthy, well-informed individuals, as well as middle and low-income people. No distinction here. Ponzi schemes are not unique to the United States. They have attracted investors in Russia, in India, in Albania, in Romania, in Portugal, in Costa Rica, in Haiti, in Australia, and more. These schemes pose a number of puzzles. First, how do they do it? Second, how do these con artists sell their stories? Third, why is it so difficult to uncover these frauds? And fourth, what kind of persons are these con artists and their victims? And fifth, how does the public view them? I conclude with the eternal question. What should we do to protect our society from such schemers? So let's start with, how do they do it? Ponzi schemes vary, yet are similar. The unique returns they offer are astronomical. For example, 10% a month when bank rates are 5 to 10% a year, or 40% within 6 to 8 weeks, or payment of $9,000 on $23,000 of investment in 30 days. Note that most of these promises involve short-term investments, and these signal low risk. The investors can say, I will see my money back soon, and that gives them comfort. Yet many potential investors may also ask, where does all this money come from? And con artists oblige. They offer first a rich variety of tales. For example, investing in synthetic rubies and tropical islands, in equipment for the use in outer space, in trading in bus stop shelters, leases of telephone numbers in Canada, investing in gold mines, in oil, in telecommunication systems, in internet kiosks, and more and more. Most stories share important features. First of all, they are exceptional, creative, and exciting. One experienced con artist was quoted as saying, gold? That's just a small part of it. You know what gold is? It's glitter. It's neon. It gets people excited. And how do con artists then gain trust and conceal the truth? There are words that reflect reliability, bank, securities exchange, certificate of deposit. One swindling organization wrote the full faith and credit of BFA, that's the organization, stands behind all our products. Well, the words full faith and credit back the federal government obligations. And then there is a mumbo language, such as money assignment and trust deed beneficial interests. And note with recourse. So you have these kind of empty words, but they sound right. In addition, con artists tell detailed stories, and details increase people's trust because they leave less space for change and expose the speaker to a risk of verification and discovery. Therefore, details signal truth. Also, prompt payments may reduce investors' concerns. Con artists always pay on time until they stop paying altogether. As one con artist said, any story will do, as long as payments are regularly made. Most importantly, con artists use stories that are costly to verify. The gold mines are hard to find. The sources of income is in a faraway countries, such as Thailand, Hong Kong, Malaysia. A secret in a story can establish bond of trust. A little wrong that both parties commit bind them in a delicious conspiracy for gain. So in one case, the proposal was to invest in a scheme that was not exactly kosher. It involved just a tinge of safe illegality, like insider trading tips, but from abroad. And the arrangement shows that con artists trust the victims. This invites reciprocity. If I trust you and I trust you first, you should trust me, right? Then there is friendship and the appearance of wealth. The con artist seems to be as wealthy as the potential victims. He shows no inclination or desire to advise, let alone manage his friend's assets. But sometimes he may be convinced to do so, just as a favor, because he's so successful in his investments. So now let me continue. How do con artists reach their victims? And how are the stories sold? The lifelines of these con artists are publicity and reputation. They must make their offerings as public and for as long as possible. Therefore, they live in the right neighborhood, rubbing shoulders with the right persons, becoming members of the exclusive trust clubs, and they show generosity, engage in civic activities, all well publicized. How do they contact their victims? They usually approach family and friends first. But soon, these sources are not enough. The next promising investors are institutions, like banks. One investment of such institution equals investment in many individuals. But institutions, investors, may be too close to regulators. Or more accurately, the regulators may be too close to them. So therefore, charitable and religious institutions are more attractive to con artists. They offer relief from regulation and some taxation and are an efficient way to raise large amounts. And affinity groups are similar to institutions. Their members are almost as connected as one institution. They trust each other, they meet often, they share information, they influence each other. employees, as a matter of fact, constitute such groups as well. And in Australia, a group of policemen fell for such a scheme not a few years ago. In addition, members of religious organizations share faith and values. They may tend to believe more than to examine. In one case, a con artist was sued for refusing to comply with a court order to refund investors' quote, gifts. So he explained that to do so, I would have to deny my faith in God. His supporters crammed into the courtroom and murmured amen when his attorney asserted that the state's action violated constitutional protection of religion. There are many such additional cases. Con artists also draw immigrants from the home country. In November 2005, a Filipino man confessed to defrauding hundreds of middle and low-income investors, most of whom were members of the Filipino community in San Diego area. But the most effective distributors for con artists are paid salespeople. Bernard Madoff, who was already mentioned, used FIDE organizations. They were attracted by generous commissions. Fund managers everywhere wanted in on it. And in Latin America, in Asia, and in Europe. It is rumored that by the year 2008, one-third of all Geneva fund managers have invested with Madoff to the tune of $14 billion. Yet, why is it so difficult to distinguish con artists and their schemes from truthful people and honest businessmen? Well, one reason of the difficulty is that in many respects, the behavior of con artists is similar to the behavior of everybody else. Humans have a natural ability to pretend, sometimes to lie, and seek to influence others. We give exaggerated compliments or laugh at a joke, which we don't think is very funny. Pretending is a gift humans possess from a very early age. You've seen a child take a banana and say, hello, hello. In addition, we smile indulgently when a toddler manipulates her parents into buying a toy. She instinctively knows how to do that. Besides, lying and manipulation can be respectable profession, such as acting, and entertainment, such as poker playing. Moreover, the structure and image of many Ponzi stories can be legitimate and familiar business. The difference between banking and some Ponzi schemes is not in the structure of the institutions, but mainly in the truth of the information. And after all, most legitimate businesses borrow, so do individuals, except that they have a chance for repayment. It is also hard to distinguish con artists from salesperson. Salesperson often talk customers into buying what customers would not otherwise buy. Salespeople may exaggerate the virtues of their offerings, and they may use the pressure of reciprocity by offering, for example, free lunch. They attempt to forge friendship with the customers. So it is very similar. Even business failures are not unique. Failing business people may stop operating, but they may also start a slippery slope towards a Ponzi scheme. It doesn't come at once, it just goes slowly. In addition, many con artists behave like entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are creative, optimistic, and less affected by failures. Their offerings are usually unique. Con artists are similar. entrepreneurs are project-oriented. This, this, and this. Well, so are fraudsters. Con artists seem to have a grandiose dream of making a fortune, gaining recognition and respect. And they may act out their dreams. That can make them very believable. And this issue brings us then to our next query. What kind of people are the con artists and their victims? Well, con artists are different from most people. Behind the facade of Dr. Jekyll, the benign physician and healer, lies the psychological makeup of Mr. Hyde, the killer. Con artists are likely to have a narcissistic character. Narcissists are consumed by self-love, an insatiable appetite for money, prestige, and the need for other people's attention and adoration. Yet at the same time, narcissists seem to have a deep feeling of inferiority that must be denied. They withdraw from other people to protect themselves from feeling inferior. They need and feed on continuous admiration and assurance, and yet they cannot admit that need. To continue to exist, they view others as shadows or things that help feed them. This may be the reason why con artists cannot feel any empathy for others. They focus not on how their victims feel, but how they behave. They watch carefully for actions that signal weakness, and then they zero in on the points of exposure. Their charm may derive from absence of social anxiety and guilt feelings. There are none. The study of actors may help understand these fraudsters. The study suggested, at least one that I read, that actors must feel nothing because feeling will be an obstacle. Actors think their characters and make their thoughts their own. And perhaps con artists view their victims the same way. The narcissist's life is organized to maintain an illusion of superiority. A person who called himself a crook explained his nature in a revealing way. He emphasized two points. He said, first, criminals like me, he said, consider your humanity a weakness to be exploited in the execution of our crimes. But second, he said, we can steal more money with a smile than you can steal with a gun. This invokes both ability and pride. Con artists tend to boast. One boasted, for example, of being a child prodigy, and another announced that he was a financial genius. And there are many such bragging stories, but I can't keep you much longer on that. Con artists usually deny that they've done anything wrong. Many argue that given more time, their enterprise would have become legitimate businesses, and they blame the government for their failure. So one Australian con artist said, the Australian Securities Commission press release said they shut us down because we were destined to fail. Well, they ensured we failed. And there's another United States con artist who wrote, the SEC over the past 3 years has deliberately contrived and implemented a violently hostile, mafia-oriented type of combative posture versus my business and against me personally. So they blame also the law. Laws hindered legitimate business, undermined free enterprise. The laws are unnecessary. They deal in trivia and are unjust, and so on and so on. And to add insult to injury, con artists sometimes blame the victims. They're stupid. How could they believe a scam like mine? That's a quote. The victims are greedy. In the late 1800s, a prominent con man was quoted as saying, "Each of my victims had larceny in his heart." It seems that con artists are repeat offenders, addicted to the game. Many white-collar criminals do it time and again and again. One person served 7 years in prison for fraud, and then he spent 10 years as a fraud investigator, and yet he's done it again. And in April 2011, he pleaded guilty to a stock fraud conspiracy. So, what are the victims like? Well, first, let me say that no matter what, victims are victims. And even if they are at fault, I feel for them. I feel and I share their anger and their sorrow. They have been hurt. But yet, let's look at their character. We noted two types of victims. The first type is less wealthy and sophisticated. These are the followers in affinity groups in religious and charitable organizations. Upon discovery of the fraud, the members of these groups seem to continue to support the con artist no matter what. They are fascinated by the fraudsters, even after losing their investments. And now I speculate. I can't say I'm an expert. I can't say I even found some basis for that. But I speculate that they admire the con artists and identify with their success, even though it's their money that made that success. Sophisticated victims react differently. There was a study in 1990 that said or described that they experience self-blame, shame, and guilt. They fear social indifference and isolation. They expect their family and friends to condemn them. How could you do such a stupid thing? And they expect no empathy, no sympathy, and no fury at the con artists. So what kind of people are these victims? A 2010 study produced a profile, of the people most likely to be drawn to the schemes. It suggests that the victims are driven by two strong tendencies. Trust that borders on gullibility, that means trusting too much, and heightened risk tolerance. These are people who tend to take high risks not only in this situation, but in other situations, climbing mountains. And these are people who are optimistic, who rely on their own knowledge, and compared to non-victims, are more educated. These victims are also drawn to small and select groups, and that's quite interesting. People want to be part of a group. They don't like to be alone. But at the same time, they would like to be unique. And an exclusive small group offers the highest satisfaction. So now we come to the question of how does the public view the con artists and their victims? America is ambivalent towards its fraudsters. Note the name. These people used to be called confidence men. Now, confidence was changed into an affectionate, diminutive con. And the word man was changed to artist.
the words speak for themselves. Corns are barren and destructive creators. And here I must add my own. Like cancer cells that do not follow the structural rules of the body, corn artists do not follow the social rules of the body politic. A body can tolerate some abnormal growth, but if cancer cells continue to play havoc with the structural rules, the body will die. If corn artists spread over the population, the health of the social body is endangered. The public views professional con artists as crooks, but they are ambivalent. Nevertheless, they may be admired for their cleverness. In contrast, I believe legitimate business persons who turn to fraud may evoke less sympathy, as if people are saying, "We expected better of you." Perhaps people feel that honest persons gone wrong betrayed their own kind, and that's why they are less sympathetic. The public view of con artists who defrauded small investors is also somewhat ambivalent. After all, small investors could consult and protect themselves. Arguably, it may not be so difficult to detect these schemes. There are many warnings. The Securities and Exchange Commission and others published lists of red flags. Stripped of all the diversions and feelings and excitement and fascinations, there are many elements of fraud that wave a danger sign. And therefore, America is ambivalent in its feeling towards victims as well. So, what can we learn from the stories and analysis of, that we have covered? We learn that con artists mirror trustworthy people, that deceitful actions can resemble legitimate activities. Those who seem to be entrepreneurs may produce nothing. Promises of extraordinary profits can be and often are false. Following others may be efficient, but also dangerous if you follow blindly. We learn that society is populated by people who mimic trustworthiness, who may also be self-centered, ruthless narcissists, and that there are true victims as well as foolish or fake victims. We recognize that con artists are addicted to the game and can corrupt others. America, nonetheless, does not condemn con artists as it would, say, slayers of helpless people. So recognizing that trust and honesty are indeterminate and realizing that people follow many routes with different measures of truth, we may conclude that just a little bit of dishonesty will always be with us. So a little dishonesty is acceptable or even justified. Well, herein lies our greatest danger. A society that accepts a little dishonesty as a way of life is headed towards deception and abuse of trust on a grand scale. Because con artists resemble us, the true danger is that we may become like them. Knowing that fully self-enforced honesty cannot be achieved does not mean that accepting a little fraud is the way to go. And here I raise my voice. Some people suggest that the best crime prevention is investor education. After all, investors can say no. Yet this education has been tried for years without success. Who wants to read copious disclosure documents and evaluate the potential risk and benefits of financial instruments that they offer? And who has the time to become an expert in this area? And therefore today, more than in the past. We ask, how can people protect themselves from financial frauds? Well, it is not as difficult as it seems. I suggest that it is not, provided we maintain self-awareness. Let us recognize our own vulnerability to con artists allure. After all, very few of us remain entirely insensitive to some aspects of fraudulent schemes. Knowing our weakness can constitute our strength and protection. In Greece, the temple of Apollo in Delphi carried an inscription, "Know thyself." Even the great Achilles had a vulnerable spot, his heel. People who are aware of their weakness, for example, people who have a tendency to be addicted to gambling or to alcohol, can either succumb to their tendency or avoid casinos and drinks altogether. We may read or be told about a person who became a millionaire in no time. We may wish to become millionaires ourselves, too. But if someone with the characteristics of a con artist approaches us with a great tempting offer, or our friends tell us excitedly about the wonderful once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, we may stop and consider our own tendencies and say, not now. Thank you. Let me think about it. Having paused, notwithstanding the pressure, we will be safer. We might lose a good opportunity, but avoid a disastrous investment. Knowing what draws us, we will be more cautious, more questioning, and more skeptical. This approach does not necessarily turn us into suspicious and mistrusting people, but it helps us remember the power of an enticing story and captivating people. It can raise our awareness of hasty and risky decisions. This awareness can help us become wiser and, in the long run, probably wealthier. And this awareness may protect us, our society, just as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, thank you.
Professor Franco has agreed to take questions and actually would like to take questions.
Yes.
So there are mics on both sides. Please step up.
Tamar, as I was listening to you, this won't surprise you or anyone who knows me, I was thinking about politicians. Because almost everything you said about con artists seems to me to fit. You could tell a parallel story about political con artists, including the rational ignorance that pervades the so-called victims. One could draw analogies between Ponzi schemes and Social Security, persistent systematic deficit spending. Are there material differences? Are there material differences between political con artists and financial con artists, either as a descriptive matter or as a psychological matter?
Well, I think there is a basic difference. First of all, they are much more in the limelight. It's harder to hide. Hide the good, hide the bad. But in addition, what you find is that from time to time, when things are kind of become dicey, as you would say, you find that Congress itself passes a rule, like the rule they passed now that imposes upon them insider trading prohibitions. And this is insider trading, not that they know, but that they create, because they know that they are going to create that benefit and therefore they bought it before. That goes far beyond the usual securities prohibition. So I would say yes, there is a big difference. I would like to have to say a bigger difference, but there is a difference.
Hi, Tamar. That was a great speech. Thank you. Have you yourself ever been a victim? Or have you personally known a Ponzi scheme artist?
You know, I'm not so rich. But also, money is not the thing that grabs me. And for that reason, and I said that before, for that reason, I was not approached, neither did I approach con artists. But you asked me something else, and now you had two parts to the question. What was the second part?
Have you known them?
Have I known any? I've known people who violated the law in Israel. I was a lawyer, and there was a time my father was alive, and I said to him, I want to see what criminal, or not criminal lawyers, but lawyers who deal with criminals are like. And he said, you won't like it, but why don't you try? And I tried, and I didn't like it. But the fact remains, I did find it wasn't in finance. These were other types of criminals. But yes, I saw them. No, I didn't like. I didn't like to even protect their rights. But that's my fault. Somebody has to do that.
Tamar, I greatly enjoyed your lecture. Most of the remedies that you mention involve education, knowing yourself, knowing your vulnerabilities. Do you have proposals for changes in legal regulation that would better protect people from these schemes?
I do. And as a matter of fact, I admit I even became activist on that level. We have a lot. Well, let me start with this. Our financial system is composed of two parts. One is institutions, the banks, the insurance companies, and so on, mutual funds to some extent. The other part is the market. We have for some times believed, or at least have us believe, that the markets can solve a lot of problems because the markets are efficient and so on and so forth. So the result was a movement of the financial intermediation from institutions to markets. Well, we have been eating crow because of that now. And that is because markets do not solve problems. People do not think for themselves. People follow the crowd. And the result is what we had, bubbles and then crashes and the rest. So I would suggest what I suggested is to some extent an attempt to protect or to push back the bubbles that come from this herding following. But if you ask me whether we should do much more. We should contract that and go back to institutions and not believe that the market will do it. And that's why one of the suggestions also that I made, and I made it to people in the SEC, to Mary Shapiro, as a matter of fact, is don't tell people to ask what is being sold to them. Tell them who is selling them. And that will be much easier to understand. I want to know, did you go to prison or didn't you? And the result will be to divert from a hopeless situation where people can't possibly understand complex arrangements, even those who think they could, and put them on a better ground, because they can evaluate people better if they do what I suggest here.
Yes, I was just wondering, since you've done a lot of the case studies and read many various Ponzi schemes, what happens to be, quote-unquote, your most favorite story?
I think my focus was not on... Oh, wait a minute. I can't really answer you that. My focus was not so much on how the con artists worked, but on how the victims reacted. But I would say that maybe it's not exactly favorite, but it's interesting. There were some con artists that drew crowds because of the way they behaved, the way they showed that they are somebody special. And it's interesting, there was a man who was called, and called himself, the Don. And he behaved like a mafia Don, but it was, people were fascinated by how he managed to draw them. He was very able, and as a matter of fact, he worked for the FBI for a while. He did a lot of things. Some of them were so, some of them were so, you know. At the end, he was brought to the court and the shame of being brought, you know, with these manacles was so great, he committed suicide. And so, if you ask me, it wasn't it drew me because he was a person who couldn't help himself either. But these stories are not really, I must admit, amusing to me. They're sad. Both ways, both sides. You had another one.
Tamar, hi. Thank you very much for your talk. I really enjoyed it. So I appreciated your description of the typology of con artists. And the way you describe them, it sounds like they're incorrigible and almost sociopaths. And if that's right, I wonder if they can't help themselves, is it possible that legal sanctions might not be the best remedy to try to sort of change their behavior?
I don't think that you can change, and that I must admit, it's not that I don't think. I didn't think about changing the behavior of con artists. I thought about protecting against what I consider to be, well, sick people. I think they are, but they are also dangerous. And therefore, what I would like is to see people understand that these are dangerous people, and the way is to protect yourself by saying, hold on, don't come close. I don't want to hear you. Because they are very adept and drawing people. It's not that they look terrible. They look wonderful. And they play into our weaknesses. And that's what I would like people to understand. I have a weakness. I'd like to be this, that, and the other. Then let me stop and see what is around me. That's why I don't know how to, and maybe I heard from one psychiatrist that he had a client who was such a person. Yes? But quite frankly, I didn't ask what he did with him. And maybe that's a good subject for another book.
Yeah, my name is Alex Valdovinos, and I'm studying international relations. I have a question. Given your strong background in these Ponzi schemes, did you have any suspicion about Bernie Madoff and his Ponzi scheme? And I guess my second question would be, do you have any suspicions over any financial transactions currently?
Oh, that's a very simple question. Okay. First, I never heard of Madoff until I heard of Madoff, but then everybody else did. But the point is different. You want to know how to prevent these actions. Is that correct? And the answer seems to me to be that it depends on us. If we have a culture of people who say, I don't want to hear all of that. If we have a culture of people who are a little more, not so gullible, not necessarily suspicious always, but not so gullible, you know what would happen? These people will not find the customers. And so to some extent, it depends on all of us. But it can't depend on one. It depends on the culture. It depends on how we understand what is right and what is kind of doesn't look right. So that is one of the reasons why I wrote this book. I'd like people to take a little more control of the desire to be rich tomorrow. Maybe they should wait a few days. Thank you very much. Hey. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Professor Tamar Frankel from Boston University School of Law. Professor Frankel's lecture was titled The Ponzi Scheme Puzzle, The Story Behind Some of the Biggest Liars in History. She was introduced by Boston University President Robert Brown. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.